Hey, folks, welcome to another episode of Footnotes, helping you become a more informed neighbor, advocate, and believer. I'm your host, Dr. Jamar Tisby, and this time we have on the show someone who is no stranger, and it is the one and only Reverend Dr. Esau McCulley. If you're not familiar with Dr. McCulley, he is a professor at Wheaton College. He is an ordained Anglican minister. He is a New York Times opinion columnist. He's breathing very rarefied air as a writer, and he is the author of several books, most recently, How Far to the Promised Land, One Black Family Story of Hope and Survival. So I get to interview Dr. McCulley about his book, and you'll hear in this episode, we go way back. We are friends on and off the mic, and so we get into it a little behind the scenes, a little into the nitty gritty. We talk about the Black family. We talk about interracial marriage. We talk about how to talk to kids about things about like anti-Black policing and so much more. This is a memoir from his personal life. He bears it all for us. And throughout it all, he weaves his faith. He weaves his journey into Christianity and how believing in Christ helped him through some very difficult circumstances as a child and growing up. So I very much encourage you to purchase the book. I endorsed it. I think we put the blurb in the show notes if you want to read it and enjoy this interview with the Reverend Dr. Esau McCulley. Doctor, Reverend Esau McCulley, my friend, welcome to Footnotes.
Yes, it's always fun to be on a podcast with people who you also text and talk to on the phone.
So that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
We're professionals, though. We want to treat each other like we know what we're doing.
Thank you for having me. Help, but it's fun that you talk about, you know, us connecting offline and in real life. And we have some good conversations because our stories parallel at some points, intersect at some points, and recently on social media, somebody encouraged us to get back on the mic together.
Yes.
They recalled a quote that I use every now and again, where I talk about Black people in white Christian spaces who talk about racial justice either get pushed out, burned out, or sell out.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that it's very difficult to exist in these spaces and persist in these spaces. So we had, I think, talked about this maybe on a podcast or not. Maybe they were wanted
to. It was actually Disruptors when I used to host podcast with IVP. And I'm trying to if anybody's that dedicated, they can go and find out what the timeline is. I think it was 2019 or 2020. And it was either before Reading While Black came out or like within a year after it came out. It was somewhere in the beginning of kind of my public work in this area. And so you were like the old head, even though we're the same age, give me some advice about my future.
And look at you, still at your office at Wheaton, I presume?
Yeah. I think that it is true. One of the things, this relates to Christianity more broadly. One of the things that you have if you're a Christian long enough, you see people who, for different reasons, kind of take different paths and they kind of no longer a part of the Christian community. There's always a sadness to that. And related to that, kind of as an analogy, you do see kind of the carnage that comes from what happens to African Americans in justice work, just over, like you see it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you kind of, there is a certain sense of mourning when you see how people who start with the best of intentions end up really discouraged and broken. And so I think that, there are people who give up, like you said, who say it's not worth it. I think that for me, it was like burnout, sellout, or what was it? What's the third one?
Pushed out.
So hopefully I haven't sold out. That's something to decide about the community. I am on sabbatical, so maybe I got close to burning out, but I'm taking a year off to do some rest. They haven't pushed me out yet. I think that I'm going to give you a fourth one.
Okay.
I think that there's a possibility of carving out your own space. And I think that if we are looking for Sorry, I'm going to steal all of your stuff. And then I know we got to do the rest of the podcast.
Keep going, rock and roll.
I think that if we can carve out our own space and recognize that our job is to be witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and that it's not our job to win the ultimate victory, that's in like God's hands. And sometimes if we're looking at the external fruit of our labor, we can sometimes be discouraged.
Absolutely.
But if we say that as best as I can discern, I'm going to do what God called me to do and the results are up to him, then I think it's possible to persist in this work.
Mm.
And I think about like how, you know, I feel like we can't have a black conversation without talking about Dr. King. But like when he died, it wasn't like the movement was doing great.
Right.
And whether or not, you know, his last, you know, we don't know, right? Like, was he thinking in his head, oh, the movement is floundering and it's a failure.
Mm-hmm.
But the full legacy of what he had done couldn't be seen. I'm not saying me and you are Dr. King and Shuttlesworth. I don't know who would be Shuttlesworth, who would be King. You be King, I'll be Shuttlesworth. but I think that what we can do is be comfortable with, I will offer what I have to God and let God decide what he's going to do with it. And that's what I've tried to do is carve out my own space and say, I'm going to be over here doing me. I'm not going to fight with y'all, but if you want some of the smoke, it's free.
Plenty to go around.
Yeah.
I will say it is in my view of the landscape with race and Christianity in the U.S. right now, the space you've carved out is pretty exceptional. You've been able to be a legit scholar of the New Testament. If folks are watching this on YouTube, you're wearing your St. Andrews.
Space. Oh yeah, St. Andrews. Wrong side. I do it every time. It's the mic. Yeah.
Where you got your PhD in New Testament. You are a college professor at a very well-respected liberal arts institution, Christian school. You're an author, of course. You're a national speaker. You're ordained. Like it's a lot and it feels pretty exceptional. Do you think you've navigated, in a way that's different than some others, even like myself, in the ways that you've been able to carve out your own lane?
Well, I think part of it is, there's a couple of things. One is hopefully you learn from the people who came from before you. And so although me and you are the same age, you have been in the public for longer than I have. You were talking about the fact that you've been doing Pass the Mic for 10 years. And 10 years ago, that would have been 2013. I was beginning my PhD at the University of St. Andrews. Before that, I was living in Japan. And so in some sense, I saw the way that certain African-American Christians who spoke about race were then treated and then how the community they built turned on them and they had to kind of rebuild, right? I saw that kind of pattern play itself out over and over again. And so what that showed me is, well, I might as well be myself from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And although it may be slower, if I build from a beginning a community that understands what I am, what I'm about, then there is no like, oh, there is no kind of like, oh, we're turning on you now because we thought that we owned you.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've tried to do from the beginning, this will be funny. I know we were talking about Hop Out to the Promised Land, but I remember when we were reading My Black, and they were asking me about the cover, like what kind of cover do you want to have on the book? And I literally, this is the advice, I wanted to look as black as possible. And when I was writing the introduction to Reading My Black, and the introduction begins with Outkast at the Source Awards. That's like, yes. So like, if you want to say like the first time somebody read something from me, they read about the South got something to say.
It's about Atlanta. As black as you can get. Yes.
And like, if you, it's like, if you know, you know. And so I think that has been helpful. But the other thing is, and this is actually true, we talk about this a lot offline, but we'll put it on the mic. It's discipline specific.
Mm.
And I talk about it in passing in some of my work, but what often separates certain forms of evangelicalism from like the Black church or Black Christianity is different understandings of American history,
mm-hmm.
and the glory narrative of American history. And when you challenge that narrative, even though it's not initially theological, when you challenge the narrative of American history or even the church's complicity, called the compromise, that gets people's ire. And because I'm in biblical studies, the center of my attention isn't the critique of evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. It's actually, you know, interpreting the Bible and, even lauding Black biblical interpretation. One of the other things that's really interesting, and then I know we got other stuff. People often ignore the Black church anyway.
Come on, yes.
And so because I speak about Black people a lot in my biblical scholarship, they don't know what to do with me because I'm not yelling about, like, oh, he's talking about how Black Christians read the Bible. Now, we read it differently, and there's reasons why I don't talk about it. And so I think that because of my discipline and my genre and my focus, it kind of puts me over to the side. Yeah. Another good example, and maybe I don't want to call her name, but maybe she'll like it. But like Jasmine Holmes' recent book, is it Carved in Ebony? I forget the name of it. Crown of Glory.
There we go.
Like it's Black abolitionist literature, right? And it critiques, you know, because of Black abolition literature and the history of kind of like what we've done, it critiques, you know, the people who are in the way of liberation, but it does it on the way to something else. And so I think a lot of times when we're actually telling our own story, people just don't get as enthralled about it, even though the implications of our story are a real challenge to the narratives.
Absolutely.
So if I wrote Reading While Black Against Evangelicalism, then it would have probably probably would have done a little bit more, right?
But would have hit different.
That's not my energy.
I do think you're right on two very important points. All of what you said I agree with, but just to highlight one, discipline specific, right? Because even though what you're saying is quite disruptive in your biblical studies work, there's less on its face objection because you're talking about the Bible. Evangelicals love that, right? And it is very evident that you are a scholar. So in my view, they would have to do a lot more homework to kind of come in and refute some of the things you're saying. Not that they do, but if they want to do it well, right?
Well, I mean, that sounds very nice and that's kind, but like you're a scholar too. You got a whole PhD.
Yeah. But so here, like, you know, there's the difference. So, I mean, you're in a particular institution that people know the reputation. You're also in a particular discipline. I think you got more or less your sort of start while you were in the academy in terms of when people started to come to know you, you were already in the academy. I've gotten my PhD expressly for writing for the public. Wasn't really to become a tenure track professor or anything. And because I've written for, you know, trade presses and not academic presses, it's just a different whatever. Yeah. The other thing. Is around what you were saying around the discipline. History somehow has become woke and liberal in the minds of a lot of conservative Christians. So just as a discipline, just as an area of study, people are beginning with a level of distrust. And I think that feels like it's increased over the past 10 years or so, but now it's almost as bad in their minds as like sociology or social science.
I think that for me, it really is. I think that for me, maybe I'll put it this way. I also, because I respect disciplines, often refrain from conversations that are at the center of the public discourse. So if there is something that I might have an opinion about, but I'm as a scholar, you have a higher bar for what you feel competent to discuss. And because a lot of the hot button issues are related to history, sociology, there aren't my disciplines. So I tend to major in what I major in. And so what I think of, well, if you need a historian to answer these questions, I would direct you to a historian. What I can say to you is, here's how the Bible shapes the moral imagination of people. Now, one of the tricky parts about being a biblical scholar is that does put some limits on you, right? Mm-hmm. Because I can speak about the moral imagination and how it shapes our approach to issues. But because I'm a biblical scholar, policy isn't my strong suit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So because sometimes I'm more conceptual than policy oriented or historically critical of institutions, then my critique sometimes seem a little muted. Mm. But it's not muted because I don't have an opinion. It's because I don't feel like it was my call to speak on those areas. Yeah. And so I can, you know, I always say to people like, you know, Mike, I don't have a policing policy platform. They said Esau, like, what would you say about police? Like, just don't kill black people. Like, in the sense of, like, if they're innocent, don't. I mean, it may seem to be superficial, but, like, there's certain things where I feel like, as a scholar and as a Christian, I can raise the awareness of an issue. Mm-hmm. And what I can do is I can shine a spotlight on it. And then I'm assuming that all of my friends and neighbors who have competence in the relevant areas take advantage of that spotlight, right? I sometimes I don't even have the qualifications to shine the spotlight. I've struggled. I don't know when this podcast is going to come out, but we're in the middle of the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
That's right.
I'm not even sure I have the competence to even shine the light. I just want to say, protect civilians, right?
Yeah.
But there are people who are competent in that area who are educating us, and I'm reading and trying to learn. And so I think that biblical studies by nature is a little antiquarian. It's kind of historically, you know, before the current struggles. And that gives me a little bit more space to be conceptual and operate in that way.
And first of all, that's a brilliant articulation of why scholars should be more measured in what we say publicly, even though we have an opinions. I mean, you're one of the few people who has a regular column in the New York Times where you share your opinions. And so you do, but it is very measured. And your discipline, while it slows you down, I think in a good way, from just hot takes, right? Not just putting out your hot takes. It also gives you a deep reservoir of research to pull from. So we very much value that. And all of this actually dovetails into the excuse for this conversation. Not like I ever need an excuse to talk to you, but this is a good occasion. We're talking about your latest book, How Far to the Promised Land, One Black Family Story of Hope and Survival in the American South. Full disclosure, I gave an endorsement for the book and was very glad to do so. But it dovetails with the conversation we're just having, because your public facing work as, you know, a biblical scholar, as a professor, as a writer, all of that wouldn't necessarily or automatically lead you to write this book, which is a memoir.
Yeah.
So different genre of writing. Why this book? Why now?
Well, it's really interesting that, like, all of the conversation we just had might be undone by what comes after this. And maybe it's related to it. It's because one is there were some issues that I wanted to talk about that I couldn't directly address in my scholarship or even in my columns, that I felt like I had an opinion about that I could do through the lens of story rather through the lens of analysis. So the book covers like three generations of my family's life, maybe even four: my great grandmother, my grandparents, my parents, and then me. And it looks at the language of how far to the promised land. And this might help people to understand. There's this passage, actually not in, they didn't have promised land at all. I think it's in like Micah, where it says, they will beat their swords into plowshares. And then the King James will say, and they will study war no more.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be no one to make them afraid, and they'll all sit under their own vine and fig tree. And anyone who knows anything about Black literature knows that the language of vine and fig tree actually then reverberates all the way through the rest of Africa. Like, it becomes a literary trope. As a matter of fact, when Amanda Gorman gave the poem, she referenced the vine and fig tree in the poem in the inauguration. And so the idea was this idea of safety, when there was no more violence, that in a lot of the history of African-American culture, that we've been subject to violence. Mm. We wanted a place to call our own, our 40 acres and a mule. And the idea of how far to the promised land is like, how might we arrive there and how long is it going to take to get there?
Mm-hmm.
And the story, by looking at the stories of the generations in my family, by telling the stories of a Black family over 100 years, and I say it this way, a Black family always contains the story of America.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens to America, we don't have money to buffer us from it, right? Yeah. So if there's like, if Jim Crow exists, we feel it, right? The civil rights movement, we feel it. And so by telling the story of a Black family that just exists in the South, all of American history lands on us. And so I wanted to be able to tell that story, but I also wanted to be able to tell, and maybe this is kind of one of the undergirding passions about it, I want to be able to tell the story of finding God in that context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a lot of memoirs, like Christian kind of spiritual biographies, where there's this spiritual journey where the person, you know, I say a lot about C.S. Lewis. Like he's in England. Mm-hmm. And we read their story, even though we can't identify with England, we say, oh, there's something about his longing that we can identify with. But if you're Black and you're Christian, or you're thinking about God, the journey to God is over and through racism, right? Maybe I don't want to be totalizing in that claim. When we're trying to figure out who God is, we're trying to figure out who God is in a country that doesn't often love us. And we're asking, can I believe in a God that allows this kind of world to exist? And so people, and maybe I wanted to put into one place all the things that people said I couldn't be at the same time.
Wow.
And what I mean by that is there are people who like the Jesus part of me, right? The fact that I love the Bible and that I'm a Christian. And it's like, if only he would do less race stuff, we'd love him even more. Or the people who say like his racial and not his cultural commentary is cool, but he brings Jesus into it too much. And so I want to say, well, no, it was precisely in this context and I'm figuring out the question of God. Hmm. And so when people ask me, this is a book about racism, or is it a spiritual journey? I was like, yes, yes, it's both. Because, right, the hush harbors, right? How, where and when do our ancestors make sense of God? In the context of slavery and oppression. And so how far to the promised land isn't just my journey. It's like the journey of multiple people who are attempting to figure that out. And so I guess I wanted to be able to tell that story so that people who are also on that journey to God might have confidence to do so. And this is my last time rambling. Then I'll let you get a question in. One of the things that, this is providence, right? When Reading While Black came out, it felt like we were trying to ask the question, like, can I be a Christian in this changing context? Mm. And is the Bible a friend or an enemy on the road to justice? And I want to say the Bible can be your friend. The God that you encounter there is a friend and not a neighbor. And 4 years later, we're in 2023. And I'm going to talk about deconstruction in a very careful way. Is that now the questions aren't necessarily initially exegetical, they're mm-hmm. experiential. Mm-hmm. Like we've been so hurt, people have been so hurt and wounded by the church or people that they trusted, they're struggling to imagine a form of Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. So the initial thing in that context isn't to throw Bible verses at them. It's to sometimes just to be with them and to tell them about your own struggles. And I didn't know that. It wasn't like a market thing. I would do a market analysis. We're heading towards a time of spiritual trauma. But the book is actually dealing with overcoming trauma on the way to faith in the context of a culture that's coming to grips with its own trauma. And so I think that hopefully it's useful in that regard, that they can see someone who experienced kind of religious, personal, family trauma, but at the end concluded that God was still good.
I think you got your finger on the pulse. And I'm very glad for the timing of this book and the style of it, like through these stories, through these personal testimonies. And what's so interesting is you start the book by talking about this event that you were part of with Lecrae and sort of going through the thought process of what to say to these folks, which was mostly a white audience. And you decided that they needed, and by extension, we need to hear a story that's not about you, or at least not just about you. It's a family story. It's a community story. So I'm just wondering, like, in your view, what you think we gain by telling this broader story, and what do we lose by just focusing on ourselves in memoirs like this?
So in the context, the author asked me, I was in an interview with Lecrae, and they asked me in him, can you tell us about the most racist thing you ever experienced? And the whole point of that question was for us to speak about how we went through something and overcame. And we're the heroes in the narrative. We have an inner resiliency that allows us to handle and thrive. And I think that idea, and I've seen it pervade the culture, that the solution to our problems is an act of the will. Mm. Right? The entire idea of manifesting stuff and wanting it bad enough, you can make it happen. Mm. Makes it seem like indirectly the poor stay poor, the oppressed stay oppressed because they didn't want it bad enough. Mm-hmm. And I just reject exceptionalism as like the means of racial progress. It's like, doesn't work. Because the reason I say that is because I know people who wanted it really bad.
Yeah.
I cannot honestly say that I wanted it the baddest in my neighborhood. That's just not true. It's right. It's a lie. And right. Sometimes it's a lie that we perpetrate because it benefits us to tell that story.
Mm.
And so the other thing that happens when you tell kind of a rags to riches story more broadly is that your community only focuses the backdrop of your inevitable rise to greatness. And I want to say, my community wasn't focused on me. My community was beautiful in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
And my community, like, how did I get the convictions that I have about racial justice?
Yeah.
Where did they come from, right? Where did the sensibilities and my belief in God, where did all of this come from? It came from seeing the lives of ordinary Black people.
My God.
And seeing the struggles that they went through and the indignities they had to deal with, right? So this isn't like a demographic analysis. You might call it confirmation bias. I don't have to ask questions about what it was like to be Black in America because I was Black in America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I saw other Black people in America. And I saw the coverage of Black people in America as a child when I didn't have a voice. And so I haven't forgotten any of those things. And so for people to understand me in so much as they care, they need to see the community that was around me, the people who shaped me, and their testimonies. And this is what I was trying so hard to say, are beautiful in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see them, you now have to deal with their testimony too. In other words, once you meet my great grandmother, you got to decide how you're gonna function in the world after you haven't met her. Mm. In the same way that I had to decide. When you meet my Aunt Clarice, when you meet my grandfather who's a pastor, when you see what they did to us on the cotton fields, right? When you say there's a man walking the earth, right? My grandfather, who was a tenant farmer, who was economically exploited, right? And you see the legacy of that comes into my mom's family, my mom's life, and then into mine. You got to say, well, then, hold on. My understanding of racial progress and justice needs to account for the lived experiences of a Black community. And wow. So I was hoping to make people see, and maybe by seeing that, they might get a better understanding than a narrative of one individual person.
It's actually quite biblical. You use the word generations.
Yes.
And the Bible all over talks about generation after generation, how families are shaped, how communities are shaped. And it's almost never just the individual. It's how the community crafts a culture, a narrative, traditions, views. And so I don't know if that was... forefront of your mind, or you're just shaped by all of that. But I really do appreciate getting to know not just you, but also your family.
Can I tell you like a couple of these stories that at least are important to me as I think about them? One of the ones that, like, maybe nobody cares about this, but this one blew my mind. I talked to my grandfather about Brown versus Board of Education.
Mm.
He was like a young person when this occurred. And I remember so vividly, because I studied in the history books, the picture. You know the picture where the girl is sitting next to like her mom and the newspaper's open and he goes, schools have to be desegregated.
Yeah.
And in my brain, as a kid, I thought every single parent in the country sat down with their kid. It was almost like emancipation. We did it. But I realized it was more like Juneteenth. My grandfather said he didn't even know the day that it occurred. He said, we didn't have a radio.
Wow.
We didn't have a radio. He said, I went to school the next day. I mean, I went to work. He had to drop out of school for a variety of reasons. He was 16 years old. There was a lot of reasons why he had to drop out of school. But he's like, I just went to work. Like nobody did anything.
Normal day.
And I was like, what do you mean the world changed? But it shows you what we read in history books and not what happens in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know, obviously, massive resistance to segregation. I knew about it. Conceptually, the Brown Board of Education led to massive resistance, and there was a long period of time when I talked to my granddad, and he goes, "No." And then my mom was like, "Not." She's like the second oldest. She's the first one in her family to go to desegregated schools.
Mm.
She starts in first grade, right? But then you think, okay, she's in desegregated schools. But now I talk to her, and what is it actually like to be the only Black kid in a desegregated school, when it's not on the news, right? We know about, once you get to Little Rock, we know about these stories when the military's involved, right? And like they have to force Black integration. But what does benign neglect of young Black girls in the 60s look like? And so, like, that's what I'm talking about when we say this stuff. And she talks about how there was this honor society, this Greek, like, it was like kind of like, you know, how you get into college by having this thing. And she talks about applying over and over again to get into this honor society. Mm. But it was all white. And they kept saying to her, well, you're just not the right fit.
Ooh.
Well, she tells this story. I don't think this one even came in the book. It wasn't. Because here's an outtake. She tells a story of how there was a Black girl who got invited to the homecoming by a white guy in the school. And he was one of the popular guys in the school. And then a day or two before homecoming, he says it was just a joke. And they humiliated this girl.
Oh,
and almost led to a riot at the school. And they did all of that just to shame that girl.
Lord have mercy.
And how they would, at the school, they would, like, even though the school's integrated, the white kids would sit in this part of the school and at lunchtime and the other kids. And so I'm like, well, hold on. This is the 70s. Like, I'm born in 1979. My mom goes, she graduates in that time. I was like, what are we talking about when we talk about the long tail of anti-Black racism?
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. This isn't demographic studies. This isn't like, you know, I couldn't do like Jamar's 1,000 footnotes, but I can tell you what happened in Huntsville. And I think that by telling you what happens in Huntsville, you get an understanding of the context into which we say, does God care about this stuff?
100%.
And struggling to answer that question is yes, is kind of what How Far to the Promised Land is about.
Man, there's so much good stuff in here.
All right, I'm talking you to death, man. No, it's when I talk, like I'm talking to you. You're my friend. You get the truth.
So, I want to jump to the chapter where you talk about falling in love and marrying your wife, Mandy.
Yeah,
and you're in an interracial marriage, and you wrote this because I really love the way you handled it. Right, it's very sensitive, particularly in the Black community, which was what we'll get into. Yeah. You said, "What shall I say then to the people I disappoint?" And meaning that you didn't marry a Black woman like others might want you to. Life is wide and strange and wonderful. And stories are made by individual persons, not tropes. We move through the world, and if God is merciful, we fall in love. My marriage to Mandy is a manifestation of one of the many possibilities when individuals that are thrust together in school, church, and the workplace. I didn't marry my wife to obtain some place in society that was denied me as a Black man. I married Mandy because, fool that I am, I fell in love. So help our listeners understand the tension for you as a Black man marrying interracially, especially to a white woman.
Yeah. So I think that the reason I put that into the book is because our journeys to where we're going to be is sometimes just has unexpected twists and turns. How far to the promised land? It doesn't end. And I think that there is this stereotype that I had when I was a kid that the path to upward mobility was like interracial dating. And so I grew up as the child of a single mom. And so when I was a kid, my dream was actually to grow up and marry a single Black mom. That was like what I thought I would do. It was always my plan. But I realized that I think that people may have a misconception as to the social cost of interracial dating. And I wanted to talk about that without making it sound heroic, but just being honest that for some people, it will mean that, you know, because of the way the Black women have been stereotyped and pushed to the side, people may perceive there's some kind of anti lack of love or concern or appreciation for Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to be able to be honest about that reality and explain, not like to apologize, but to explain the context into which like my life developed. And so for me, it was really a way of saying like life is complicated and people are complicated. And that in reality, and it really depends on the worlds in which you move, right? There are places where interracial couples achieve extra social status that exists in some places in the world. Mm-hmm. But in like the Black community, it's sometimes met with suspicion. And for someone who's committed to and cares about the flourishing of Black and brown people, it was not a strategic move to like acquire something. So it was more of a reflection on something that I didn't necessarily see. I saw a lot of interracial couples are the key to racial reconciliation conversation. And I saw that, you know, interracial couples are like a bad idea for a variety of reasons. And I saw that like interracial couples are about social standing. Mm-hmm. And so those just weren't true to my experiences, but I didn't want to sound too defensive and be dishonoring to like the real reality that they're just like, we know the rates as the kind of what my mom, right? And the rates of like Black women remarriage and all of those things. I want to be sensitive to it and just explore it from the context of someone who lived it and hope that that might be able to help people who are dealing with some of the same things.
I mean, it actually really resonated with me, particularly because you all met in a college campus ministry setting.
Yeah.
And one of the things she said was like, there just really weren't any sort of similar Black ministries at that time. So you're thrust sort of by circumstance into proximity with white people and white women. That was similar to my story, becoming a Christian in evangelical context, high school, then going to college that was Catholic, but 85% white. And ending up in Reformed circles, which again, pretty much white. So I had a lot of romantic experiences with white women before I eventually married a Black woman. But a lot of it wasn't by choice or strategy. It was who I was around and the relationships that got built over that. So now you have biracial children.
Yeah.
What do you tell them in terms of dating interracially or who they may fall in love with?
Well, I tell my children like that what really matters is first and foremost, hopefully a spiritual connection. Mm-hmm. They share kind of the same values. And so I hope that they marry people who love the Lord, and I hope that they marry people who respect and honor them. Mm. That those are the things that I think are important. And I do. I think that. That's pretty much what I say to them. I explain to them like the complicated natures of all relationships and how, you know, a marriage is the collision of different histories, cultures and backgrounds, and that it involves mutual sacrifice. So I've not really instructed my kids in that regard. I kind of make sure they understand basic stuff about dignity and to make sure that people aren't like dating them or interested in them as some kind of like experience. So we have that kind of conversation. But as far as like me telling them who they, you know, that's not really been something that I've talked too much about.
Yeah, you're making too much sense.
I'm not trying to give people couples advice, but you asked me. I think that what some of the things that beyond basic compatibility, which is important for people to consider, like having a common telos, like spiritual goal, like we're trying to be like Jesus, makes the life in a marriage more feasible. But I think that Jesus is important, but so is cultural understanding. And that it's important that if you're in an interracial marriage, especially if you're part of the dominant culture, to take the time and the energy to really learn and understand, and don't use Jesus as a cover for ignorance or like lack of analysis. And so I was blessed to have someone in my life who did that, right? That she never tried to like control like my own spiritual development, my interest, the work that I felt was important. I felt like I've always had a supportive partner. And I know that sometimes when people are married in peacetime, racially, and then strife comes up, I know this other couples have struggled during that kind of reality.
Yes.
But I can't speak to that because that's not my experience.
Wow. That's deep, brother. That's deep. Do you think the landscape has changed or the views on interracial marriage have changed from when you got married to now?
Yeah. But don't get me in trouble.
That's what we need.
Yeah, I know. I would say like, yes, I would say that people are. Yes, I think that people are more skeptical now than they were. I guess they would have been 18 years ago. And I think that it remains true that God wants the gathering of the nations together to worship him. And even if an interracial marriage isn't a manifestation of like the global nature of the church, it's not doing that kind of work, but it's a possibility. And I think that there might be a little bit of excessive skepticism. I'll just put it that way. But right, I mean, but born of like real hurt and experience, yeah, right? Yeah, and yeah. So I don't want to be dismissive, but I'm just like, yeah, like I understand some of the hesitancy that people might have, and I'm not telling people to do it. It's not like everybody go and do this. I'm saying like, well, no, like it's a possibility. It's one beauty that can exist non-competitively alongside others. And I think that we have to find ways to have all kinds of marriages flourish. One of the things that actually happened is we'll use an education example. Like there was a time when we all went to HBCUs. And we thought that going into majority white institutions were going to solve all of our problems, but they didn't. Mm-mm. But the reality is there's going to be students who are HBCUs. There's going to be students at majority white institutions, going to be students at Catholic institutions. They're going to be students at confessing Christian institutions. And the question is, in whatever category those students might find themselves, how do we help them thrive? And I think the same thing might be true of marriages. Like in whatever marriage someone finds themselves in, interracial, same culture, how do we help them thrive?
Yeah, I think that was very measured and wise. And I think I'm glad you said it, because I actually think that will be a surprise to some white people that there's more skepticism. It won't be a surprise necessarily to Black people or people of color. So it's just helpful information. While we're on the topic of what you're teaching to your children or young people, you said you don't have a policy around policing, but I wonder if you would talk about this section, Donut Crumbs and Crack Rock. briefly tell us that story.
Yeah.
And then, like I'll ask, you know, kind of what we're teaching. What do we teach our children at this point?
So I'm driving. I'll never forget this. I'm in my mom's Mitsubishi Galant. I'm listening to Bone and Biggie, and the drum beat makes it impossible. It's impossible to like drive the speed limit. Like, you like, you're 16, 17, you dumb, just drive fast, right?
I still remember Biggie's verse. Ooh.
Yeah. Dangerous. Anyways, I'm driving down the road. I think I'm going like 50 and 35. I forget what it was. And I get pulled over going through my neighborhood. And the police officer comes in. He's going to give me a ticket. I'm guilty. Like, give me the ticket. Like, there's no beef there. I was speeding. I should have been speeding. Bone and Biggie got me. I lost. And in the process of getting ready to get this ticket, the officer says, what's that in your car? And I looked over and I was like, nothing, sir. He said, get out of the car. And I'm taken out of the car and I put in a police handcuffed and put in the back of the police car. And if you lived in Huntsville, you would understand this. The street that I'm on is literally the street that it feels like everybody passes on the way back to their house. It was after the basketball game. So I'm in the back of the car as the entirety of Northwest Huntsville sees their, you know, the football. And everybody knows my car. I'm hemmed up on the side of the road. They slow it down. They look in there.
Wow.
And so I'm in there. I don't know. It could have been 20 minutes. It could have been an hour. And they're waiting for the drug task force. I see that to arrive. So the guy comes in, a second set of cop cars come in, and he goes over into the car. I can see this stuff. He like he puts his hand and he puts it to his mouth and he says something to the police officer who had arrested me. And then the drug police guy goes away. And then the guy comes back and says, you could go home. I didn't even get a ticket that day. And it wasn't until I got back to the car that I realized what it was. I had Krispy Kreme donuts. You know the white crust for Krispy Kreme? You've eaten and driving. It gets in the sweetness of it. And I guess he thought it was, crack or something. And one of the things that I realized, and I thought about this a lot, was that racism or just robust incompetence, right? Which one was it?
Mm.
And I said, well, I wonder if they were driving in a nice neighborhood and the guy was listening to John Mellencamp instead of Bone and Biggie, would they have assumed in that nice white neighborhood across town that the Krispy Kreme donuts was crack?
Right.
And I think the answer is no. one of the other things that was really interesting about that is my mom, we went home and told the story to my mom. I thought it was funny, right? Like, he thought it was crack. It was Krispy Kreme donuts. So I got to the punchline and my mom doesn't laugh at all. She's furious. She's like, you know, you could have got arrested. They could have shot you, blah, blah, blah. You know, I told you I'd do this in all of these streets. I'm like, well, mom, I didn't actually break any of the rules. You know, my mom gives me the talk that, African Americans have. You do this, 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 and you'll survive the night. But the thing that was interesting about that is that, yeah, I was speeding, right? But that wasn't what got me into trouble. What got me into trouble was the donuts. Mm. And you could, as a Black person, follow all the rules of the road and still find yourself in a dangerous situation. The other one that I talked about in the book that was like the one that was really interesting, I was driving from Huntsville back up to Suwannee while I was going to college, and a police car came behind me and a friend of mine, and it was going from 50 to 35. And I knew it because I've been through those small Southern towns, and the guy pulls me over. I never forget. It was an amazing line. Mm. He said, "We pulled you over for a sudden change of speed." I'm thinking to my mom, bro, it was from 50 to 35. I know what the thing is. You're not going to catch me slipping. And he says, well, where are you boys going? Boys, now we grown. Boys. And I said, we're going back to college. He said, I don't believe you. And he asked for both of our licenses, even though one person was in the passenger seat. He was not a driver. And our student IDs.
Goodness gracious.
And he takes our student IDs and he goes open, he runs out. I don't know what he was doing. I don't know what he was doing over there. They had to go to the car and you come back and you find out if you get to go home. And he gave us back our IDs that you boys go straight home and don't stop anywhere else. And it was that moment that I decided I was going to move out of the South.
Mm.
Because there's only so many, I don't put it this way. It's hard to consistently deal with disrespect. And to swallow your pride for the sake of making it home. And I felt like the language of boy was intentional because it was repeated. And I felt like the taking of a student, I've never heard of someone asking for a college ID for no, and listen, we were in the middle of nowhere. We were in the middle of literally nowhere. Mm-hmm. So the legal niceties of whether or not he could ask for our licenses and take our student IDs was irrelevant, completely irrelevant. And I said, well, what happens if at one point someone calls me a boy and I grumble something under my teeth? And all of a sudden, I'm now in a totally different situation.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was more, I understand the difficulties that comes with policing in America. I have a complicated job. I have an uncle who's a police officer. But like, I also understand the complicated nature of being policed in America. And I just didn't want to consistently be like what you find is the danger of two bad days happening at the same time.
Mm. Mm.
And I've been blessed not to have had bad days emotionally in the context of all being pressed emotionally. But if you get those two things together, then it becomes tricky. And so I don't have a solution to that problem.
Yeah.
I can just tell you my lived experiences leads me to think we need to imagine a better way of policing our citizens. And I can tell that story and then say, hey, historians, explain to me where this came from. Hey, policymakers, explain to me a way to fix this problem. But me, as a Christian, I can also say, well, both me and the police officer are made in the image of God. And that both me and the police officer deserve basic dignity and respect. And in the same way, I can't, you know, assume that, you know, someone can't assume just because I'm black skin that I'm going to be like this kind of certain person. I don't necessarily stereotype police officers. Mm-hmm. And so giving people a core humanity and understand that maybe even they want to be better, but they don't know how.
Mm.
Because I remember when I gave a talk, I won't say the city because who knows if they might listen to it. I gave a talk in the city, but one of the guys who came to me after the talk was a police officer. And he said, you know, I've met people like that in the force And nothing frustrates me more than how difficult it is to like perform the situation. Like he was saying, like, I want it to be better.
Yeah.
But he felt like in some ways his hands were tied. And so I just want to say maybe the beginning of changing things like that is the conversion of the imagination. Mm. And so what I'm trying to do in that part of How Far to the Promised Land is help people to imagine what it's like to inhabit Black skin that we carry around the South. Because that's complicated.
Ooh, that is so good. And I keep telling people, let us not forget the importance of anti-Black police brutality in the current movement for Black civil rights and justice. Like that was the tip of the spear for the Black Lives Matter movement and for so many other protests and whatnot. And every single Black man I know has stories like the ones you've just related. I've related some of my own, and we have to do something about it. But I do appreciate the way you navigate that a badge doesn't automatically make you bad, that we have to approach and navigate people as image bearers of God, even in the context of law enforcement. As we come to a close here, I am about to write my first memoir.
Yeah.
What tips or advice do you give me?
I made you put this in the podcast so everybody would know. I would say there's a couple of things. I think that there are stories that happen in your life that won't let you go. Hmm. And you're going to be tempted not to tell that story. I'm going to encourage you to tell it.
Ooh, come on.
The last chapter that was added to the book was the final two chapters that were written that were not in the draft. Was Fools Fall in Love and Fathers and Sons Revisited. Like the stories around my father and our name was written within the last two or three weeks before the book came out. Wow. And I felt like that's stories that I had to tell. And Fools Fall in Love, it wasn't even in the manuscript. I said, I'm sending this to you all. There's a chapter that I didn't tell you about. This is what you need to know about that story. So I would say there has to be some courage. Mm. That's involved. And I always like to say to, and you know, this is a writer, write yourself in the corner and trust God to write you out of the corner. In other words, what I try to do as a writer is not write a problem that is easy to solve, but write the problem that actually exists.
Mm.
And so what I, especially when we talk about race and injustice, we sometimes say, oh, it isn't that bad. So it's less of a load. But sometimes we have to write ourselves into a corner to find out what it is we believe and what might be helpful to us. The last thing is like, be yourself. I always feel like, and maybe this is why I felt so passionate about putting Fools Fall in Love in the book. There's a version of Jamar that everybody likes, right? Like there's a group of people who like this part of you, a group of people like that part of you. And there's a tendency to like become the person who people like.
Mm.
But I would encourage you in the writing of your book, keep all the parts of you that make you you in place. And if people don't like it, people don't like it. And hope that when you release the book, people are talking about Black people. We know as writers, people fall in and out of the mood for consuming Black literature. So just pray that you come in a moment where like,
right,
ready to receive it.
Bro, because attention is fleeting.
Attention is fleeting.
Well, I want to close on just this question that I like it when people ask me because I always have something to rant about or something that's just on my mind that I'm passionate about at the moment. So I just want to give you a moment on the soapbox. What is on your mind that you feel really strongly about? Could be something heavy, could be something light, but just go off for a minute.
That was probably I am very passionate about Black writers right now. And I wish that people, and I know this sounds self-serving because I'm a Black writer, but I think that if people know me, they would know that I spend a lot of time supporting, helping, mentoring, in the ways that I can.
I can testify.
Helping African-American writers get their place. Because I know how the market works. And I'll say currently the Christian market is the people who are condemning evangelicalism have a huge market share, and the people who are defending evangelicalism have a huge market share, and all of the energy in the room is sucked up in this 100-year war between the left and the right of evangelicalism. And when Black literature is released that centers Black stories, it's hard to find a place for it. And there's a lot of talented Black writers where they're struggling to find an audience. And especially some of our Black women who are just putting out quality work that is falling on deaf ears, often because the industry doesn't know how to reach into Black communities and, yeah, and market them. Yes. And so I know a lot of Black writers are trying to figure out what publisher can get me into the community. How do I gain an audience? And I want to say that reading, purchasing, reviewing, and sharing even up-and-coming and established Black writers is of vital importance, because publishers are followers, and every single successful African-American book makes room for another successful African-American book. And what would make me happy, this is the end of my rant, what make me happy is we got to a point where like a bunch of Black writers could win at the same time.
Come on.
And right now it's like one Black book and then 6 months, another Black book. But, you know, is there a possibility to have an ecosystem of a variety of African-American Christian writers who are writing their conviction, who love the Lord, who offer these gifts to the world, and say there ought to be enough room for everybody to win? And one of the things that is like, oh, this, I'm so frustrated. It is really hard to transfer platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can endorse, you can do this. It's like, mm-hmm. It's like you feel limited as a more established Black writer, even helping them out. And so I just want to say, if it's on your wish list, buy it. If you buy it and you enjoy it, recommend it to people. Like, if you know, one of the ways that you can be an advocate is to support people whose call is literary, because I think there needs to be a record of what's happening in these spaces. And don't just buy all the books telling you that you're doing things wrong. Look at the books to show what African-American Christians have done right.
Yes. Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot, brother.
I think Darina Williams has a book that's come out pretty recently. Jasmine Holmes has a book that's come out pretty recently. Truth Table has a book that you can always go and get. Natasha Sister Robinson, she has some material. So those are three or four people that you can go ahead and purchase now. If you want to purchase them before you purchase my book, you know, the McCullers Will Eat will be fine. And do you have a rough estimate as to when your book's going to come out?
Well, my very next book is with Zondervan Reflective, and that comes out August 2024. It's called The Spirit of Justice, Stories of Faith, Race, and Resistance. The memoir will come out after that.
Okay. Listen to y'all. They can't pre-order it yet, can they? Can they pre-order
it? Not yet, but they will know. Just follow me at Jamar.
When the pre-order drop, y'all need to pre-order it. Okay, I'm done with my commercial. You can kick me off the podcast now.
Reverend Dr. Esau McCulley, it's always a pleasure. The book is How Far to the Promised Land, One Black Family Story of Hope and Survival in the American South. You can put into practice what he just talked about by buying the book immediately right now. We thank you for your time, brother.
Thank you, sir.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Compelled Podcast, which uses gripping, immersive storytelling to bring Christian testimonies to life. Listen to missionaries, addicts, martyrs, and more who have seen Jesus at work in unbelievable ways. Listen on your podcast app or compelledpodcast.com.